Have you ever noticed something about someone in your life that they do not notice about themselves? Usually this kind of phenomenon happens to those who are closest to you. And it's one that actually happens all the time. And it's very clear whenever you're noticing it in someone else. I mean, we tend to have friendships and to live with people and to know all kinds of people that might be very intelligent, very smart, but don't have much insight into massive things in their life. But of course, there's this element of, even though we see that at work in everyone else, it's so hard to see it even in ourselves. Even to know that this dynamic is always at play, this problem with self-blindness, we rarely think it applies to us. I recently had an encounter like this, where I was introduced to myself and a little surprised. Actually had a few this week thinking about this passage, but I tend to go around and I like to think about myself as a humble guy, which is a statement in and of itself that's a little revealing, right? As one writer says, when you think yourself to be humble, you have ceased to be so. But I digress. Anyways, I like to think, yeah, I'm a pretty humble guy. I don't get easily agitated and bothered by things. But recently, I was at a community event, and there was a guy there that I think a lot of, a very successful guy. I tend to look at him as a very important guy, and we're friends, and we've been acquaintances for some time. But I also find myself getting a little self-conscious around him. See, this is a guy that I especially want to make a good impression with. And so we're at this event, and I see him there, and I decide I'm going to go over and talk to him. And so I go over and talk to him, and I'm really hoping to, you know, chum it up with him and really connect and, you know, for him to think I'm great and everything. Well, I notice that during this, we're at a Little League baseball game, and I notice that as I'm talking to him, he's not paying very much attention to me. In fact, he's distracted the whole time. I mean, he's mostly watching the game there. And I started getting more and more self-conscious. I started thinking to myself more and more, what is it not? Do I not matter? Is what I'm saying not important to him? Is he too good to pay any attention to me? Does he have no reason to listen to a preacher man? And I start to become self-conscious and get preoccupied with myself and wonder, why is this guy not paying attention to me? And then all of a sudden, whenever the inning turns over, he runs out onto the field. And I'm sitting there, and I was just perturbed. I mean, it just got me. And I'm sitting there just rehearsing it in my mind, rehearsing the perceived insult that I had just received. And I started to feel contempt for this friend of mine. I started to tear him down in my mind. I started to think, well, is he just too important? I don't need him anyways. He probably just goes around thinking he's important all of the time. And so we leave after the game is over, and I'm rehearsing this in my heart, and it's eating my lunch. It's just corroding my soul. And finally, I just had to share with Ashley. I said, hey, I'm struggling. Let me tell you about what happened there. And she said, you know, very sweetly and softly, as a wife that's noticed something that I'm blind to, she says, yeah, did you know that he is the assistant coach of the team? Did you know that the reason that he was preoccupied with the game was because he's the coach? I didn't realize it, but I had gone up and tried to have this long, in-depth conversation. I was more concerned about me than I was about what was going on. And the whole time, he was trying to be polite to me and not blow me off, but at the same time, pay attention to the game. Whenever the inning turned over, he had to go out and coach. And I was ashamed. It hit me in that moment. Why was I so quick? Why was I so quick in the moment that I felt insulted to begin to tear him down, to begin to think there was something wrong with him, to become so angry because I was hurt? Maybe you can relate. Maybe you can relate on a daily basis, perhaps, like me. What happens to you when you receive a perceived insult from someone? Or what about whenever someone brings a criticism to mind? Whenever they bring something up they've noticed in your life? Or what happens whenever someone gets something that you really want? Something that you've been longing for? Or perhaps it's even someone who takes something that you feel like belongs to you. What begins to happen in your heart? You see, contempt and anger, they come upon us in a moment, and we seldom even realize it. And we seldom really think twice about it. You know, we live in a culture that's filled with contempt and anger. In fact, in our culture, contempt and anger is a form of entertainment. It's a national pastime, right? I mean, we're always watching and listening to talk shows and political commentaries and all of these things where one group of people is vilifying another group of people. And it tends to bolster us in our rightness, especially whenever you're listening to someone who's reinforcing everything you already believe and tearing down the other side or the other party of the other people. And we love to watch them just get on TV and just battle it out. Or even if you think about what's mostly on TV now, it's reality TV shows. Now, I'm sure no one in here watches reality TV shows, but somebody must, right? Because they're on constantly. Why are we so fascinated with reality TV shows? Because we love to see people other than us get so mad and so filled with contempt and fight with one another and come up with schemes to get back at one another. We're fascinated by it because it's a picture of our reality. And as we watch them play it out, it tends to make us feel like, mine's not that bad. We seldom think twice about anger and contempt in our life. See, one of the natures of anger and contempt is it tends to make you feel so right. It doesn't even feel like a thing. It's all about the other person. But what we see in our passage is that Jesus has some words for our anger and contempt. And His words are absolutely shattering. Shattering if we have ears to hear them. But His goal is not just to shatter us with reality. It's to drive us to Himself that He may heal us. That's what we'll see in our passage. So let's look at our passage. We're in Matthew 5. As you know, we've begun a series in the Sermon on the Mount. And one of the things we've been calling this series is a picture of resurrection. So Jesus here in the Sermon on the Mount is picturing for us life as it was intended to be. It's a picture of the kind of life that God created us for. It's what it means to be fully human. And He's laying this out for us and calling us to this. And it's His intention to redeem us into this picture. But last week, if you remember, we looked at some very, very important verses as Jesus describes the nature of His teaching, I mean His ministry. And He says this, "Don't think I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. Don't think that I've come to do away with the law and with everything that has come before me. I didn't come to do away with it. I came to fulfill it." See, it's easy to get the wrong idea about Jesus. It's easy to think because of what He came to do that it no longer matters what you do. That God's law no longer matters. That God's holiness no longer matters. It's okay. Jesus came to bring peace and chill, right? And then, right after He says that, a correction about His ministry, He says this, which would have been a shocking statement for His hearers. The very verse before our passage begins, He says, "For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." Now see, this, to His audience, or to anybody in that day, would have been a shocking statement. Are you serious? You mean I've got to be better than those people? The best people? You know, the Pharisees were the most holy, righteous people you would ever see. The most religious people you could even conceive. I mean, as you looked at them, you wouldn't say, I see what they're up to. No, you would have looked at them and said, man, I don't measure up. I'm not like them. They're on the inside. I'm on the outside because I can't do it like them. You see, Jesus is saying, your righteousness must surpass that. So what does he mean by that? Well, the rest of the Sermon on the Mount is fleshing out that very statement. You see, what he's doing is he is contrasting the teaching, the false teaching of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law with his own teaching. Notice in our passage how it begins. Verse 21, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not murder. But then in the next verse he says, but I tell you. Now this is actually a little pattern that he repeats over and over and over throughout the rest of this chapter. If you have your Bible, you can see in verse 27 as he moves on to talking about adultery. You have heard that it was said, but I tell you. Then again in verse 31, you have heard that it was said, but I tell you. Verse 33, verse 38, verse 43, he does it over and over and over. So what is he doing? He is recalling what they've been taught by their teachers. Here's what you've heard about the law. Here's what you've heard the law means. But here's what I'm going to tell you. And so right here, he reminds them, you have heard it said, do not murder, and whoever murders will be subject to judgment. You see, virtually in their teaching, he is quoting the sixth commandment in Exodus. You know, the commandment that do not murder. But you see, he's not contrasting his teaching with the commandment, but rather the Pharisees' false teaching of the commandment. Because, you see, here's what they were teaching. The law is simply a matter of the action. It's simply a matter of the externals, of the behavior. And so they would have taught, according to this verse here, that command is only speaking to the action. And so as long as you don't kill anyone physically, you're good. You've kept it. That's all it refers to. You see, this is how they approached religion altogether. Is that being right with God, being accepted, being on the outside is simply about keeping a certain short list of external actions, avoiding a certain number of things, and doing a certain number of other things. And that's what it means, and as long as you do that, you're in. But you see, for them, it was a way of actually avoiding dependence upon God. You see, if I can be good enough, if I can actually lower and reduce the standards of the law, then I can keep it. And then in keeping it, I can be right. And I don't have to need God's mercy, and I can exalt myself over other people. And essentially, that's what they were doing. That's religion. But Jesus contrasts their teaching. He says, you've heard them say this, that it's simply about the action. But here's what I tell you. Anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, raka, an Arabic word of contempt, is answerable to the Sanhedrin, the Jewish council. But anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Wow. Jesus, are you serious here? Are you kidding me? Jesus said, no. It's not just the action. It goes all the way to the heart. See, Jesus is saying, that's what the commandment is all about. It's not just external. It's all the way down into the thoughts, the intentions, the words of your mouth. And he says, that is murder. That is the equivalent. It draws the same level of wrath. Did you hear the very last thing that he said there? Saying, you fool, will make you in danger of the fires of hell. Now that's strong. If that doesn't straighten you up and shock you, you're not listening. You see, Jesus is saying here, it is not just externals that brings God's wrath and judgment. It's your thoughts. It's your motivations. You see, what this would mean is, the person who's wronged you in your life, and you go about rehearsing that wrong throughout your life, being filled with anger and contempt against them? That's what he's talking about here. He's saying that's murder. The person that just tends to drive you up the wall, the person that fills you with such frustration and contempt, perhaps it's your spouse, perhaps it's someone in your family, that just fills you with criticalness and anger, Jesus says, that's murder. Perhaps it's someone in your life, a coworker, that tends to navigate and play the politics and always gunning to get ahead of you at work, and it drives you absolutely nuts and fills you with anger. Jesus says, that's murder right there. Perhaps it's someone in your life like a mother-in-law or someone that just tends to see your faults with incredible, impeccable accuracy. Do you have anyone like that in your life who just sees all your faults and has a way, perhaps backhandedly, letting you know what they are? And it fills you with anger. You know what that's like? Jesus says, that is murder. And then he begins to show us two kind of application situations. Jesus says, okay, here's what it looks like in everyday life. The first is the context of worship. He says, therefore, this is how this would apply in your life. Say you've come to worship, and you're coming to the altar, and you're bringing your sacrifice to lay it there before the Lord, and all of a sudden, the thought hits you, oh, wait a minute. I'm not reconciled with my brother. I've done something against someone in my life that they're holding against me. We're not reconciled. You know what Jesus says to do? Leave the sacrifice there, and then go and be reconciled to your brother. Here's the idea. It's a little humorous. You see, he's speaking in Galilee. The place that you would make the offering is in Jerusalem. Quite a journey, right? And so you've made this long trek to the altar of the Lord to make a sacrifice, and you've either brought your goat or you've bought a goat there, and you bring it to make a sacrifice on the altar of the Lord, and all of a sudden you realize, wait a minute, one of my brothers and I, we're not right. I've done something to hurt him or to wrong him. Jesus says, leave the goat there. Travel all the way back. Can somebody hold my goat? I'll be back in about 4 days, all right? I got to go make something right. And go all the way back and make it right and reconcile with your brother, and then come all the way back, and now you're ready to make your offering. Jesus is saying reconciliation with one another trumps worship. Now that's shocking. I mean, this is just not a way that we think. It is possible to come into worship and to feel, oh, God is so delighted with my worship, but yet to be estranged from your brother, and God holds that in contempt and says that is murder. There is an inseparable connection between our relationships with one another and our relationship with the Lord. But then he gives another example. It's more of in the business world, out in the world. So say you found yourself at odds with someone, you owe a debt, and you feel like, you know what, I think I'm right on this one. I think you're wrong. I think we need to go settle this thing. Jesus says there is an urgency to reconciliation. It's almost an argument here of wisdom. It is far more wise to reconcile as fast as you can because you don't know what's going to happen. You might get there and find out you've been so blind about the whole situation. Jesus said it is far more wise to reconcile as fast as you can. It's important for us to pause and to feel the weight of Jesus' words here. It's crucial for us to see Jesus did not come to do away with the law. He did not come to say it no longer matters how you live. He never, ever said that. He came Here, he's raising the law to its proper standard. At the end of this chapter, he kind of concludes all that he's saying here by saying this: therefore, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. Jesus is saying, are you wanting a standard? I'll tell you what the standard is: perfection. You're trying to use the law as a way to be okay, as a way to be accepted, as a way to get in so that you're not completely dependent upon mercy. Jesus says, okay, here's the standard: perfection. Never be angry. Never hold anyone in contempt. Always consider others better than yourself. How's that coming? You see what he's doing here? He's hemming us in. He's saying it can never work that way. He's showing us ourself. So let's get personal for a minute. As you hear Jesus' words about your contempt and your anger, these hard words, what do you feel? What do you feel in your heart? What are you thinking? Now, there are some of us this morning that hear this and say, oh my goodness, are you kidding me? If that's the standard, I'm shot. I'm shot through. I'm not even close to measuring up and to being in. I must have His mercy. If that's where you are, you're right where He wants you. But for everyone else here this morning, for everyone else here this morning that might be thinking about how you're hoping the person next to you is hearing this, you know what I mean? You're hoping that someone in your life will come to understand this because they really need to hear it. You're thinking to yourself, you know, I hear what you're saying about anger, but I'm just not an angry person. I just don't do that much. And in this regard, I would say those of us who struggle with explosive anger are probably in a better situation because you can't hide it, because you're not blind to it. I mean, if you blow up, it's kind of obvious, right, to everybody. But for some of us that might be missing this, some of the worst kind of anger is the kind of icing out, punishing, quiet contempt that we hold in our hearts. For some of us, that's what it looks like. You see, the danger about anger and contempt is it blinds you. I mean, the very experience about looking at another with contempt or feeling anger towards your brother about what they've done, the very experience of it tends to put you up above, right? It puts you in a situation where you are noticing something that someone else has done that is wrong, and it's a dangerous place to be. Because in that place, you are seeing very clearly the wrong of another, but at the same time being blinded to your own. It's kind of the nature of it. It blinds you to it. So if you're having trouble this morning, maybe let's just think about today. Just today. Maybe even this morning. Was there a time this morning where you became angry with someone else? Was there a time this morning where you felt contempt and resentment? Maybe it was just trying to get everybody out of the house, right? That's like herding cats in my house. I lose it often whenever I'm trying to do that. Maybe it was even on the ride into church. Was anyone here arguing on your way into church? Maybe it's just happened since you've been here today. Maybe you've seen someone who has something you don't have, or someone who tends to just rub you the wrong way and to say things that just cut and they almost don't even realize it. And maybe it's filled you with a little contempt this morning. How long after you leave here today will you find yourself in contempt? You might not make it to the parking lot. You will not make it to the end of the day. You see, Jesus is inviting us to see our bankruptcy. He's inviting every one of us to see, if that's the standard, I'm shot. I got no hope in and of myself. I'm not even close to making it there. You've got to have mercy. You see, if you cannot see your outrageous need of His grace, His grace will be stale to you. The gospel will be stale to you. Gathering together with His people will be stale to you. It's just how it works. It's like a healthy person going to the hospital. How do you feel if you're healthy going to the hospital? It's not fun. It's not something that you would delight in doing. In fact, it's something that you would avoid. I'm going into the hospital thinking, I don't want to be here. I might get sick here. Why do I need to be here? There's sick people everywhere. But what if you're sick? What if you're desperately sick? What if you're right in the middle of trauma? What if you're hemorrhaging? What's the hospital like for you then? It's the place of life. It's the place I got to go immediately. See, that is the experience for us with God's grace. If your need, if your brokenness is far from you, it will be stale. But if you perceive the outrageous depths of our need of His grace, if you see how shot through we are with sin, that it's not just our actions, but it's the orientation of our heart, His grace will be electrifying in your life. It'll be freeing. It will change you. So what do we need to see most this morning from His words? Here's what we need to see. Jesus did not primarily come to teach about the nature of the law. He did that. He did that like no one else before Him. He revealed what God is really like, how holy He really is, how high His standard really is, but it's not the reason He came. The reason that He came, and in this moment, whenever He is teaching this, His eyes are set towards something in the future. He came to hang on a cross. He came to take our place. He came for all the anger and the violence of this broken world to spill in on Him in a moment where rage, where resentment, where mockery was breaking out on the only one who has ever been perfect, who has ever been perfectly just, who's ever been perfectly loving. And in that moment, the wrath of God fell on Him for our sins, for all of our anger, for all the ways that we fall short of the glory of God, for all the judgment that we deserve, it fell on Him in that moment. If you are united to Christ today, if you are trusting in Him, do you know what that means? You are forever received and accepted by Holy God. The same God that has these standards you can't even parse out, the same God has loved and received you in Jesus Christ more than you can ever dare to dream. He looks on us as if we're the perfect son, as if we have never been angry, never held another in contempt. We are clothed in His righteousness. So do you see, in seeing your sin, it's an opportunity to see how much deeper His grace is. As you see the depths of how far short you fall, it's just seeing how much bigger the cross is for you. You're free. You are accepted in spite of your sin. But also there's something else He's up to. Actually changing and redeeming us into this kind of people. He's actually at work through the power of the gospel. As we're set free, as we're free from our guilt, as we're free from our need to make it right, we are set free through the power of His Spirit to actually become this kind of people. A kind of people that not hold each other in contempt, but rather consider others better than yourself. That's what resurrection life looks like. One day, we will be just like Him. One day, we will never, ever, ever experience contempt for another again. One day, our anger will never explode on the people we love again, ever. That is what He guarantees to do in our life. And even now, He's at work doing it. 18 years ago, this very month, one of the greatest atrocities in the modern era occurred in a country in Africa called Rwanda. It was in 1994, and in one day, a genocide and a horrific violence broke out that would last for 100 days. And over the course of these 100 days, 1 million people would be butchered in this country. But here's the remarkable thing about what happened there. It was not a militia or a military or an evil warlord that led this genocide. It was neighbors butchering neighbors. And here's how it started. In 1994, just the day before the genocide broke out, the president of the country and his cabinet was flying back into the country, and his plane was shot down. In Rwanda, there were two different groups of people, two classes of people, the Tutsis and the Hutus, and they hated one another. 20 years earlier, Rwanda had been ruled by Belgium. And whenever Belgium gave them their independence, they decided to leave them with this gift. They divided the entire population into two kinds of people. If you had 10 or more cows, you were designated a Tutsi. If you had less than 10 cows, you were designated a Hutu. And you were given a card to represent it. It was your identity. And so what do you imagine happened in this country? They hated one another. The Tutsis were the ruling class, and they oppressed and ruled over the Hutus. And in this country, there was brewing contempt and hatred, anger. And on this day, whenever the ruling class's president, whenever his plane went down, the much larger Hutus, the leaders of the Hutus, went onto the radios, went into the streets, and called on the Hutus to kill and butcher ever Tutsi they could. And ordinary people, I mean, these weren't trained killers, ordinary people turned on their neighbors in one of the most atrocious genocides, violence the world has ever known. The country was devastated. But it wasn't long before they realized, we cannot keep all of these murderers in prison. So in one day, not all that long after the genocide had happened, 50,000 murderers were released back into the same neighborhoods they had killed in. Can you imagine? Can you imagine on the news today hearing a murderer has been released in your neighborhood? What would that be like? Well, in this case, it was 50,000. It crippled the whole country. The murderers were so plagued by shame and hatred of themselves, they were literally unable to function. And the victims, those who had seen their family members butchered at the hands of their neighbors, were so crippled by bitterness, they could hardly function in society. Rwanda as a nation was literally brought to its knees. But now, 18 years later, Rwanda is a transformed nation. Rwanda has the fastest growing economy in most of Africa, one of the least corrupt governments in all of Africa. What happened? What happened in Rwanda that today makes it a place of reconciliation? In Rwanda, it's been rebuilt by murderers and victims side by side. These villages have sprung up all over the nation called reconciliation villages, where perpetrators and where victims are living side by side. How can that possibly be? The power of the gospel. After the atrocity of the genocide, the churches in Rwanda and those from the outside began to pour in with the message of the gospel. And it began to transform the entire nation. As one leading pastor said, who saw much of his own family butchered, he said, I was filled with bitterness and hatred. But then I was struck with the picture of Christ on the cross. And hanging on the cross, in the midst of all of the injustice, in all of the pain, he cried out, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they have done. He said, it struck me. That was for me. And now that is my model to treat my brothers in my country. I saw a picture in these, on a massive scale, reconciliation has been happening. Over and over, day by day, victim and murderer are brought together for reconciliation and for forgiveness. I saw one of those on a video on YouTube. And they come together and a man walks up to another man at one of these reconciliation meetings. And he said, you killed my wife and my child. but I will do you no harm, my brother. I now forgive you. And they embrace and wept together to see the freedom of both the murderer and the victim, to see the power of the gospel to bring together people who should be at such odds, who should have such contempt between them. It is a picture of the power of the gospel and how it can redeem our world of violence. You see, this is a picture of what we are to be. Earlier in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, "You are to be the salt and the light of this world that's wrought by decay and violence." And here's what that means. In a world of violence and hatred and contempt, we are to be a people of forgiveness, of love, and of reconciliation. And as we do, we bear witness to the coming kingdom of Jesus Christ. Let's pray together.